Well, good morning, Dr. Spensieri, Dr. Kropaski. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
We are here with the Mission Health Partners Q4 webinar. And I just want to start by welcoming you to the region, to North Carolina, to Mission. How long have you been here, and what do you love about us so far?
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here. Thank you for the warm welcome. I'm coming up on 1 year in November, so I'm about 3 weeks away from being here a year. Love North Carolina. My wife is a North Carolinian. She grew up on the other side of the state. However, she's always asked that eventually in my career, let's get back to North Carolina. So I reminded her that I kept my promise, and we're back in North Carolina. So it's been great being here. It's been challenging. The year has flown by, as we can all imagine, in this unprecedented time. But I think it's allowed for development relationships in non-customary manners. So, and it's really pressed us towards dealing and seeing each other as human beings. We're all people with different points of view and with different experiences, and everyone should be valued for that. So thank you.
Great. You know, I think our region, you know, our mountain region really does pride itself on a history of providing excellent health care in a particularly challenging region geographically, with some of the things going back, you know, decades and longer, not having access to phones, not having access to certain amenities. But we've really had these amazing integrative models like MAHEC with you know, educating people in various disciplines, you know, the Appalachian Mountain Centers with the Hot Springs Healthcare Network. And then we also have some innovative programs like our LVAD program, our ECMO program. So, you know, what brought you particularly to this region, and what have you noticed in terms of healthcare delivery that is different and exciting?
Well, the reputation that you just went through certainly interested me. The history of great care, the expanded care, the ACOs. This is a very unique model for HCA. HCA tends to be very hospital-centric. My background's in internal medicine. So a few years back, I finished my internal medicine residency in New York and was recruited to Virginia. And I spent 32 years in Richmond practicing traditional office-based practice with rounding on patients in the hospital. And then in the early 2000s, transitioned into leading the hospitals program there. And then around after 10 years of that, I transitioned into this CMO role with HCA, which is an administrative role. So this presented a real unique opportunity for me to sort of get back to my roots. I'm a primary care physician at heart. I've practiced primarily hospital medicine the last 10 years of my career, but clearly understand that connection between patients being managed in the hospital and then being transitioned back to the office. So that was very attractive to me. It was an opportunity to help transition some of Mission into the HCA model. HCA is very quality-centric. What has always impressed me about HCA is how the comparisons. It's always the top box. You know, being better than your SIR is okay, but it's being in the top 75th percentile of the SIR, so or top box or top decile. So I think that was a challenge that in certainly enticed me to take on this opportunity.
Great. So I think sometimes it does take a fresh look from somebody from the outside, you know, to give us ideas about how we can improve here. So what were some of the things that really struck you when you first arrived in this area, ways to improve?
Well, when I first looked at the quality data, so obviously that's the first thing I looked at, and also the patient experience scores. And so I'll tell you what I was impressed about and what I was a little bit surprised by. What really impressed me is the consistent top performance, especially in the cardiovascular service line. When you look at some of the CV program here, 3-star in CABG and ABR, that's in the top 1-4% of the country consistently. The stroke performance has been top box consistently. Cardiovascular performance and PCI has been strong. And really the program from top to bottom is really solid. Now, I like to compare metrics to the Olympics don't come every 4 years, the Olympics come every month. So it seems like every month you're being compared to everyone else in HCA and in CMS reporting. And so you can be really good. I like to use sports analogies. You can be hitting 300 in baseball, a 300 hitter is an all-star. And so all of a sudden, if everybody else is hitting 300, now that changes the level field. So now you have to hit 325 or 350 to differentiate yourself. So, and I think in some of the work that Mike has been involved in, that's been very helpful, looking at mortality and also complications, there's also been an opportunity to explain the methodology. Because delivering good care and having it be viewed in the metrics that it's good care are two different things. Mm-hmm. You can deliver good care, but your metrics, if you don't understand the methodology, can actually appear that your care is not quite as good as you as it actually is. And mortality index is one prime example, with choice mortality, with actual versus expected. And one of the opportunities we found is that there were a great number of patients that were expiring in comfort care. And in comfort care, those patients and families don't really have all access to what hospice would offer them in those final days of their lives. And then even after they pass on for family, there's still additional family support. Yet, when patients expire in comfort care, that does appear in your expected mortality ratio. So that can alter that. As we look through the mortalities in depth, we use the Institute for Healthcare Improvement model, so that we're looking at timeliness of care, recognition of the severity of the illness, are we placing the patients in the appropriate level of care, is the treatment aggressive, or is there a delay getting to the OR? So these are all things that in the process we also begin to look at. And that engages in conversation with the medical staff. So the providers, you go back and say, hey, you know, retrospectively, there's always opportunity for improvement. Mm-hmm. Usually, not always, is usually. But it'll provide you the opportunity of knowing the outcome and then being able to critically look back and say, what could we learn from that experience? What could we have done differently? And we look for trends and we look for themes. Mm-hmm. Because those trends and themes to the clinicians on the ground are just trees, and you don't see the forest, you don't see the trees for the forest. So we are able to bring those cases back and puts it in a different perspective and allows them to take that retrospective look with us, so that we also look at our processes, our systems, and how we can consistently strive to be better.
Great. Yeah, I want to bring Dr. Kropaski into this. I know that, the focus of yours has really been on the mortality. Mm-hmm. And so, can you share with us a little bit about this process and what you've done so far?
Yeah, so I want to add on a little bit to what Tony said. So I've been in patient safety care at Mission for several years now. And with HCA coming on board, I have learned so much, just as Tony was talking about the methodology, understanding the metrics, really understanding how we're measured, and making sure that our medical staff understands that as well. I didn't understand it, and I've been doing the work, and so my breadth of knowledge has increased, and I think the whole medical staff has under his leadership, but that's something we need to continue to work on. The other thing that I get asked a lot is, does patient safety still matter? Is that something HCA values? And I can tell you without a doubt that that is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think our benchmarks have gotten even higher. I feel like before we had trouble benchmarking, but HCA has a very robust system of benchmarking. And so every month we have our clinical excellence scorecard, and we know how we're performing compared to other HCA facilities. And the standards are very, very high. So I see that as a challenge, and I see that as really exciting for us to continue to grow and improve with this new knowledge and base of expertise that we have. So part of what I've been working on is mortality. So previously we focused a lot on occurrence reporting, the RL solutions, looking at events when they happen. HCA, again, has a more robust way of looking at it, and we use things like mortality to identify opportunities for improvement. So if you think about mortality, avoiding avoidable deaths would be the ideal. And so anytime we see that there was a process that didn't go well or an opportunity for improvement, we want to capture that. And patient safety is all about reducing harm. So if we see opportunities, we need to figure out how to develop a process that's reliable, that's reproducible, and gets us to the outcome that we want every single time. So that's what we're doing with our mortalities. We're looking at them, we're looking at the overall care that was delivered, we're making sure the care was in line with the patient's wishes, so that's one of our big opportunities. Tony alluded to making sure people who are appropriate get hospice care and they get those ongoing services. We want to make sure that advanced directives are in place so that we know what patients want when they come to the hospital. And then there, once they're in the hospital, we want to make sure that we deliver the best care possible to make sure that we get the outcomes that both our patients and our staff want.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Help us understand a little bit, you know, what goes into a mortality score. You mentioned the choice data. It may be different from what others in the region use or what we used in the past.
Well, one, something that we've been doing recently on a regular basis is working with our clinical documentation improvement specialists so that we ask physicians about the care that they deliver. They always say, well, our patients are sicker than everyone else's. And that truly is the perception, because there are a lot of sick people out in the community, and we know the patients that get admitted to the hospital are more acutely ill. However, here's where the documentation is really important, in understanding the severity of the illness and the risk of mortality. And what are the components that go into those calculations? So what are the comorbidities and complications? What are the major comorbidities and complications? So a diabetic patient with pneumonia, is they're not all the same. Some diabetics are type 1, some have peripheral vascular disease, some have underlying chronic kidney disease, some have hypertensive cardiovascular disease as a component, some have neuropathy as a component. And so documenting those specifics adds to those CCs and MCCs. Mm-hmm. And so what we've been doing in a number of our meetings, our MAC meeting on Friday, and also at the service line meetings, are going back to the physicians in those service lines and providing some guidance in terms of here's what is important to document in the chart. Because when we look at our mortalities, we look at what was the severity of the illness and the risk of mortality. And the range is from 1 to 4, with 4 being the highest. All of those MCCs and CCs add up to that calculated expected mortality. So over the course of 4,000 admissions in a month, if we're not capturing all of those, the acuity and the severity of the illness, that does impact your expected mortality score. And so we've been focusing a lot of time in that area. We've also been focusing time with complications, mm-hmm. so that physicians understand the definitions of complications. And you would be surprised that busy clinicians don't have the time and the structure is needed to provide the feedback. So here's the definition for a postpartum hemorrhage. A lot of great work being done in women's and also in NICU. When you asked earlier about metrics, NICU metrics are extremely also very consistently top box. And so in surgery, in women's, definitions of postpartum hemorrhage, the definition of a laceration versus incidental versus inherent to a procedure, and the language that is not taught clinically that now conveys into the documentation is a significant gap that the facility really needs to provide to the physicians. And not only is that helpful in the documentation, but then the discussion, the physician become more acutely aware. And it actually helps reduce complications by focusing physicians on a thought process that perhaps they had not emphasized in the past. And I know Mike has been involved in a lot of that, and being that that's relatively new to you, that might be something interesting to see how your perspective is on that. And our complication rates have improved dramatically, month by month by month.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is that it's not necessarily that some of these complications are developing during an acute care hospitalization, but there are patients who come into the hospital with a lot of comorbidities that are complexities by definition. Right. And if we just knew about this at the get-go, if communication was very clear, the whole team caring for a patient would be able to embrace that and prevent any further complication better than before.
Yes, I think that's well put. I think being aware is just like when you manage a patient with diverticulitis, At what stage do you worry about an abscess? You don't worry about it on day two or day three in their care. So it's knowing and it's illustrating that highlight and that linear progression. And all documenting all the CCs and MCCs, that only accurately reflects the severity of the illness and the risk of mortality, which goes into the projected metrics. But it also raises awareness about physicians. Oh, I need to maybe pay more attention to this. Or, you know, in the OR, hey, this patient already has underlying chronic kidney disease. Maybe we use this new EV1000 that allows us to be able to hemodynamically support the patient, volume load them without putting them into congestive heart failure, keep them euvolemic during the procedure. And those are the types of things that we begin to raise awareness, and you see an added component to care. Not that it was ignored in the past, but it sheds the light on it, puts it into a much more focused perspective.
So trying to systematize that and mechanize that from the get-go.
Standardization is a word, and some have thought of standardization as bad. Actually, standardization towards best practices actually helps the clinicians, and that's all the basis between machine learning and artificial intelligence. And so rather than trying to remotely remember that as you're being distracted as the clinician with three or four other things going on, it's nice to have some of that standardization built in place that we know improves outcomes.
Mm-hmm. We want to make it easy to do the right thing. I think that's really important, is you want to set clinicians up for success. If it's really hard to do the right thing, it's less likely that as a human being we will be able to do it. Or if a mistake is really easy to make, then that's the path we may go down. So we really want to set everyone up for success. And as I was thinking about the complications and the other pieces, as clinicians, we often don't know the buzzwords, the things that go in it. You know, I describe something clinically, I don't always know the implications of words. And so learning about what complications are, the words that go along with it, the clinical descriptions, has been really important. And the other thing that's been eye-opening for me is there's a reason that metrics are publicly reported. It means they're important. It means that they impact outcomes. So complications impact bad outcomes. Other things that we measure, there's a reason. And so by focusing on those things, we are identifying big opportunities for improvement in ways that save lives and have evidence base behind them for saving lives.
Awesome. You know, I'm thinking that a lot of the physicians in our audience are people who are going to receive the patients after they go through something, a severe or an acute illness here in our hospital. And so I'm wondering how doctors working outside the admission system in the region may also benefit from some of these processes and better communication, you know, from via documentation from the get-go here at Mission.
The piece I've been thinking about is really making sure that we understand the patient's goals of care. So as care goes along and the patient's life expectancy changes or their care burden or the things that they're experiencing, are we having conversations about what they want and what they want the rest of their lives to look at? And, you know, that changes throughout the lifespan. But I think that that is really, really important for us to be doing both prior to hospitalizations and after hospitalizations. And then the other part of that is making sure we communicate it. We're working really hard in the hospital to make sure that all of our clinicians have easy access to advanced directives, that they're always in the same place in the chart, that we are getting notified if those are present. And then also working to make sure that we can communicate with our providers in the community, because when you write a discharge summary or you're writing notes, it's so easy to forget the little nuggets of truth that come out. So if I'm typing something and I'm saying something, I don't say it the same way as I do if I call you. So really thinking about how we communicate, pick up the phone, how do we talk to one another to make sure that our patients get the best care.
Yeah, I would just add on to that that, you know, in our mortality review work, you know, one of the important facets of that is to make sure that we have processes in place to respect the patient's wishes. Mm-hmm. And the only way you can respect the patient's wishes is to actually have a conversation about what are those wishes. Mm-hmm. And then share them whenever appropriate with the family. Because we know the family dynamics. So, and that goes to patient experience. Treating people the way they want to be treated, not the way we think they want to be treated, is really critical. And so I think, and then having that communication, I'm new to Cerner, and so all the HRs regardless, whoever you ask to, whichever EHR, I found over the last 10 years in my administrative role, everyone thinks their EHR is the worst ever. So there's always flaws. And I think understanding the shortcomings is really important to be able to focus on that. And how do we, again, have that information sharing with our partners in the community so that the clinicians in the community can work with us on that? How do we better when patients leave here? At least begin the conversation and then say, when you follow up with your primary care physician or your oncologist or your nephrologist, you may want to have further conversation along these lines. Is this really what you want us to do? And those conversations, I think, are really critical.
I think two big examples of that, too, is we have really robust palliative care in the hospital, and we have really robust behavioral health. And those are two things that I think can get missed. So if the palliative care team has been on board and talked about goals of care, we need to make sure that that's communicated at the time of discharge. And behavioral health as well. We know that untreated mental illness can really give poor outcomes and overall health. And so making sure we communicate things that are going on before things that go on in the hospital with our providers in the community can be really profound.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's something I would emphasize is that, you know, the community, the resources, the palliative care team, the hospice team, care partners, the ASH LTAC. I mean, we have all of the services under one roof, if you will, that patients could require. And that's really unique. That this is the first time in my career that I've been with an organization where all of that can be clearly integrated. And that clearly improves the experience of the patient, will improve the outcomes as historically they have. And how do we make that even better? So going back to my, you know, analogy about the Olympics, you know, how do we keep getting better every day, every month, every quarter, every year? And Mike alluded to this earlier with HCA, where, you know, we're not only comparing ourselves against the top CMS 75th percentile, if you will, or the top decile in NCDR. We're also comparing facilities in the 185 hospitals at HCA. And clinicians, as scientists foremost, have that competitive spirit. And the patients benefit from that. That competitive spirit, that we're looking, they rank, the facilities get ranked based on size. And not only that, but what happens is when you look at who's doing well, it allows the opportunity that law starter picking up the phone and phone a friend. So you can pick up the phone, call another facility in a different division, in a different state, and say, hey, I noticed your CLABSI scores and CARDI scores are just phenomenal. You all haven't had CLABSI or CARDI in over 2 years or 1 year. How are you doing it? So it's sharing of those best practices. And that's really where the leverage of the size of HCA helps the clinical and the quality outcome scorecard. And their phone calls, it's very top and center. It all begins with providing quality care. Nothing else matters if we can't differentiate ourselves and provide the top care that the patients and the communities deserve.
You know, particularly for our sickest and most complex patients, many of whom may be living in long-term care facilities, it seems like these would be patients that this would be a great example of improving quality communication and reducing mortality and cost. Do you have any examples of working with the long-term care facilities that has led to improvements in quality or safety?
Well, I think there's always room to do more. Mm-hmm. And I think as we continue to look at our partners, we will continue to strive to do more to improve communication. The one that comes to mind is sepsis. Mm-hmm. I know that we now have a sepsis Angie coordinator, came on as our sepsis coordinator to support what Jeannie Bollinger and her team have been doing in the clinical realm. Mm-hmm. And having that capacity to be able to send our sepsis team out with EMS, out to the skilled nursing facilities. Because historically, when you look at patients who recover from sepsis, they tend to have the highest readmission rates. Mm-hmm. So there's a high probability of those patients being readmitted. And when you look at just the presentation, when you look at most elderly patients who come to the ER with confusion, most of those will come out as the underlying cause being sepsis.
Okay.
Certainly the workup, everyone thinks neurological first and they have their CAT scan, but one of the themes that I've noticed over the years is how do you develop a parallel pathway so that while you're ruling out an acute neurological event, also get your lab work and get your census work done at the same time. So that when the CT comes back with just chronic microvascular changes, we've gotten that UA, we've gotten that YCAN, we have the lactic acid level, and that one or two borderline low blood pressures that we didn't really pay a lot of attention to, we tend to focus. And this is on our reviews. When you show that to clinicians and say, hey, look, here's six of the most recent patients that we've seen, what was the common theme involved? That really is helpful. That's how you improve the delivery of care, by sharing of information in a timely manner that physicians can then process and think, okay, now next time I see an elderly patient with altered mental status, which is a symptom, we always like to say in the coding world, that's a type of encephalopathy or delirium or psychosis, so we need to be specific. It's okay so they came in altered, but let's make sure that on our chart and at the time of discharge, that we have a medical diagnosis that classifies an altered mental status.
So I'm thinking the things that would be helpful as the person arrives to the emergency room is that we have a good history of comorbidities and other medical histories so that we know about the patients. Often when patients are really sick, they're not able to communicate. So getting that medical history is so important, getting advanced directives or information about the patient's goals of care. A lot of times we miss that, and sometimes we get too far down the road in treatment before we realize what the patient really would have wanted. And then any vital signs or other things, labs, anything that's been done before they get here, I think can help our clinicians, once the patient gets to the emergency room, be more aggressive with care. So HCA has very aggressive sepsis standards. So we're working really hard to meet those metrics. Earlier intervention means better outcomes, and there's a high risk of mortality associated with sepsis. So it's a really key piece of work in helping identify these patients early, get the treatment started as early as possible is really key.
Well, thank you both for highlighting, you know, some of the excellent work, particularly with getting advanced directives more, you know, notable in charts early on, getting things systematized, particularly in situations like sepsis, which we know is a high cause of mortality in hospitals. And I just have one last question for you both. And that is, how can we work together as physicians, join together in an accountable care organization to improve the quality of care for all in Western North Carolina?
I think that communication is really key. I mean, I am a psychiatrist, so I definitely think that we need to talk. But I think it's easy to forget that. It's easy to forget to reach out to the primary care provider. It's easy to forget those really important details when you're busy doing documentation. But I think that those make all the difference. And then my other piece is always giving benefit of the doubt. Or really understanding, sometimes I think that we can jump to judgment or other things, but I think if we give each other the benefit of the doubt and work in a collaborative manner, that gets the best outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would echo that. I think it's communication, it's that collaborative nature. We are all here for the same purpose, to improve the well-being of the patients and the communities that we're privileged to serve. That's what called us to medicine. It's that need to help others. That feeling of gratification that brings is just unbelievable. That's what keeps us and motivates us. And, you know, with the communication part, I believe it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said, the problem with speech is that it sometimes implies that communication occurred. So it's also, how do we speak to each other? Do we have effective communication? How do we make sure we speak and we hear what is being said, that we pay attention? And then we make sure that we always keep the patient as the focus of that conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Spend some time with you today.
Thank you both.